Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go flight.
Guidance.
Guidance, go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go flight.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Florida Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is the March 4th, 2012 edition of Space Talk, live on the air right here on WMMB. Thanks for joining us as we spend the next hour of this Sunday afternoon talking about our nation's space program and focus on what I consider to be one of the greatest examples of true space exploration happening today, and that is the hunt for new planets around other stars in our galaxy. We'll do that with the help of a gentleman named William Borucki, who is a principal investigator with NASA's Kepler mission, which was launched here from Cape Canaveral 3 years ago this week. And of course, you're always welcome to join in on our conversation today by asking William a question, or perhaps you have something else on your mind about our space program. Either way, I'd love to have you join me on the air to talk space. Give me a call at 321-768-1240. Or if you'd prefer to send us something by email, the address we're always monitoring here in the studio, spacetalking@aol.com. Congratulations go out to the steely-eyed missile men and women of SpaceX, who this past week wrapped up a full countdown dress rehearsal of their Falcon 9 rocket on Launch Complex 40 at Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. The test on Thursday involved filling the rocket with its liquid propellant and conducting a countdown all the way down to just before the engines would ignite. Now, this is a standard test that every launch team holds before a rocket is launched from the Cape. It gives everyone a chance to, well, not only practice the countdown procedures, but it also provides an opportunity to make sure that all of the rocket's pieces and parts are working just as they should. Reports from SpaceX indicate that everything went well, or nominal, as we like to say in the business. And this certainly is a big milestone that's reached that makes it increasingly likely that the Falcon 9 will be able to get off the ground by somewhere in the range of late April. And we'll talk more about this mission toward the end of the program today when we do review for you the live local launch forecast. In any case, for now, let's go with our weekly broadcast blog. Right now it's time for Orbital Inclinations. It seems that on any given topic, our nation is split down the middle in its opinion of which side is right or the best or should win, who we vote for, where we shop, what we eat. No matter what the question is, two major choices seem to rise to the top of the opinion polls, leaving other options behind in the noise of statistical insignificance. This week, we all live through Leap Day, that once every 4 years adjustment to our calendar that I am convinced was created to give our politicians an extra day to campaign during a presidential election year. And, of course, it is politics that seem to divide us down the middle, both numerically and ideologically. Republicans versus Democrats, take your pick. Any other choice feels like a waste of your vote. But of course, there are plenty of other choices to make every day, many more directly relevant to our everyday lives, even if they are not quite as weighty as picking the next president. For example, we go through our lives choosing between Coke or Pepsi, Target or Walmart, Ford or Chevy, paper or plastic, even McDonald's or Wendy's. Yeah, that's right. In 2011, Wendy's finally knocked Burger King out of the number two spot. So perhaps there's still hope for you libertarians everywhere. And in case there is the most profound choice to be made, at least in our house, do you root for the Minnesota Vikings or do you root for the Green Bay Packers? There is, of course, only one correct answer, and it sounds like this: go big purple. Well, how does this relate to the space program? Well, I'll tell you. Since the beginning of the space age, right up to this very minute, the debate over how to best spend our time and energy in exploring the final tier has raged on and traditionally been splintered into two camps, robots versus humans. On one side, you have all those that say all the work that is required to launch humans into space, keep them alive, and safely return them home just costs too much money and isn't worth the risk when you consider that robot probes can do the same job as our astronauts. And when faced with shrinking budgets, robotic spacecraft can give us more bang for our buck by leaving Buck Rogers at home. Proponents of robotic spacecraft point with pride to the Voyager probes, now at the very threshold of true interstellar space, a place in our universe that humans aren't likely to reach for many, many decades. The robot community can boast of successes like Galileo at Jupiter, Cassini at Saturn, and the incredible Spirit and Opportunity rovers at Mars. On the other side, you have those that say humans are the most essential part of any effort to reach toward the stars. After all, the survival of our species depends on us being able to leave this planet one day and find a way to live out there. Going out there gives us new ways to live better lives back here. And when faced with shrinking budgets, human spaceflight must remain a priority. No bucks, no Buck Rogers still holds true. Proponents of human spaceflight point with pride to the moon landings of Apollo, the winged wonder of the space shuttle, and the engineering and diplomatic marvel that is the International Space Station. Human spaceflight makes us all feel a part of the adventure. Time and again, we see evidence that astronauts are inspirational to children and power their dreams for the future, and my dreams too. Both sides have incredible stories to tell and rational arguments for their continued support. And both sides can tell tales of tragic failures, resulting in the loss of huge investments in time and money, and the heartbreaking loss of life. So why does one have to be at the expense of the other? Why do we have to make a choice between the two and declare one the winner over the other? The answer, of course, is we don't have to. Our space program is not the Super Bowl, where one side is declared victor and the other is dismissed as the forgotten loser. I believe there is room for both sides to claim the winning trophy. Data from robot probes like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter can help pinpoint locations for astronauts to set up a future moon base, just as probes like Ranger and Surveyor from a previous century helped us select the Apollo landing sites. Making this happen, getting these two sometimes bitterly divided sides to stop blaming the other every time their budget is cut, well, that's far more difficult than simply and naively asking the question, why can't we all just get along? And the answer, especially in NASA's case, isn't as easy as just giving everyone more money. Priorities do need to be set and funded appropriately. And as much as we all would love to see NASA's budget doubled, well, that isn't realistic. And even if it were, I suspect that the robotic and human spaceflight communities still would argue over their share of the pie. In my opinion, the choice isn't between funding robot probes or daring astronauts. Instead, the choice should be for both sides to do a better job in speaking as one voice in support of a coordinated and robust space exploration program that will benefit all of us right here on Earth. And that's this week's Orbital Inclinations. Well, if you'd like to add your comments to what we've just said, you can give us a call at 321-768-1240 or send us an email to spacetalking@AOL.com. And as always, you can go online to WMMBAM.com, use keyword space talk. Follow the link to Orbital Inclinations and can join in the conversation there. Of course, at WMMBAM.com is everything you need to know about this program throughout the week, who our upcoming guests are, links to archives of shows in the past, and all the latest and greatest space news when it breaks. We try to get some word up to you all the time. Well, coming up here after this first break, we're going to go planet hunting with the Kepler scientist in just a minute, so please do stay tuned. We'll have William Barucki on just in a few minutes. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB. Stand by, we'll be right back.
If you missed part of the show, catch the podcast, Space Talk, in the on-demand section at WMMBAM.com.
Oh, I'll have the grilled cheese, please.
Hot or cold?
Hot isn't grilled hot.
We're still looking to hire a cook for the summer season, so cold?
But your name is Hot Grilled Cheeseria.
Yeah, I can give you bread and cheese, and you can try grilling it on your exhaust manifold.
Don't be stuck without a chef or any other seasonal employee you need. Log on to SpaceCoastHelpWanted.com.
You know, if you have heated seats, you could sit on it and have a panini.
Okay.
Post as many jobs as you like in minutes and use as many words as you want for one low price. SpaceCoastHelpWanted.com. Long name, amazing results. Ms. Munchler, would you file these documents, please?
Oh, okay, after I take your temperature.
Why are you a receptionist?
Well, because I couldn't find a nursing job.
Then why didn't you go online and check out SpaceCoastHelpWanted.com?
Okay, sir, take off your shirt and I'll take your blood pressure.
They have hundreds of local jobs, hospitals, sales, IT.
Oops, sorry.
She's just...
Your blood pressure just went sky high.
Oh, boy.
Okay, I'm going to need a specimen. Take this...
Get out! SpaceCoastHelpWanted.com. Long name, amazing results.
State Farm Insurance.
Are you the one who bought my husband a Falcon?
Excuse me?
You saved my husband over $480 by switching to State Farm, and he bought a Falcon with it.
How awesome is that?
We can't control what our customers do with their savings.
Stop buying him frivolous things.
What do you want me to do?
Buy me frivolous things.
Save an average of $480 when you switch your auto policy to State Farm. Get to a better state. Call 1-800-STATE-FARM today. Average household savings based on 2010 National Survey of New Policyholders reported savings by switching to State Farm.
The spring around the corner, can fall be that far away? It's not too early to be thinking of a fall Better Lawns and Gardens cruise.
This year, we're going to Canada and New England to enjoy the great fall color on Royal Caribbean's Brilliance of the Seas.
We'll start in Quebec, cruise the St. Lawrence, visit Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and Joni's Stomping Grounds, ports along the main coast.
Visit our website at betterlawns.com to get all the information.
Now's the time to get on board for this great 12-day fall cruise.
Find a penny, pick it up, all the day you'll have good luck.
What if your lucky pennies could mean winning brand new items such as laptops, big screen TVs, gift cards to the hottest places, or other cool stuff at dramatically reduced prices? At thebidspot.com, it happens every day. Winners of our entertainment auctions can get new brand name items at up to 95% off retail. Register today. Enter promo code BID1 for 25 free bids. Get started now. The excitement. The winning. The Bid Spot.
And welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. Now at its new time slot of 3 p.m. every Sunday, right here on WMMB. 321-768-1240 is the number to call to participate in the program today. And as always, you can send us an email to spacetalking@aol.com. Well, growing up in Minnesota, watching Apollo moonwalks on one channel and Star Trek reruns on the other, I was completely fascinated by the idea of visiting other planets. Our moon, with its magnificent desolation, was and remains a sight to behold. And as the Starship Enterprise assumed its standard orbit each week around yet another Earth-like planet, I never questioned the notion that our galaxy is filled with other planets to explore. Now, true, when you look through a telescope at a distant star, all you see is a pinpoint of light. But I always believed there were planets up there. And now it seems we have proof like never before. 3 years ago this week, a Delta II rocket launched from the Cape and sent NASA's Kepler spacecraft into an orbit around the sun. Its mission, to hunt for planets circling other stars in our galaxy, and the results so far have been absolutely incredible. Now, to help us understand the mission and how all of this works, I'm honored to have one of Kepler's top scientists with us on the phone today from NASA's Ames Research Laboratory in California, Principal Investigator William Borucki. William, thanks for taking time for being with us and talking about Kepler. How are you doing today?
I'm doing just fine, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about the Kepler mission.
Well, good. Well, look, before we get into a lot about the mission itself, I'd like to have everyone learn a little bit more about you. Tell us about yourself, sort of give us the game show intro. You know, what's your background? Where are you from?
Okay, well, I'm from a little town in Wisconsin called Delavan, Wisconsin.
Wow. When
I was a kid, I used to watch meteor showers, you know, lie on the roof of the house and go watch meteor showers with my friends. We did some telescopic observing at the Cub Scout. There was a Cub Scout camp.
Yeah.
And we built rockets. We read science fiction. We did everything, you know, kids do that ultimately have them end up at NASA.
Wow, so a true space cadet from the youngest, just like me.
Okay.
That sounds good. So looking at the stars, staring out there, you said you wanted to be a part of that. You wanted to go explore. So when you pursued an education that led you to be an astronomer, or what's your specialty?
Well, basically, my education was at University of Wisconsin. It was in physics, although I took a lot of geophysics as well. And after college, I applied to NASA. It was the only place I applied to because if you're going to be part of the space program, you basically wanted to be part of NASA.
Yeah.
And so I was accepted in 1962. I worked on the Apollo mission.
Oh, really? What did you do with Apollo?
The heat shield in particular.
In the heat
shield.
One of the
things we were very concerned about was that when the astronauts came back from the moon, that they wouldn't burn up on the way in.
Sure, smart.
And so that was basically what our group did. After that, of course, we were successful, and they basically finished up on the mission. And then I worked on the ozone problem, because the Earth's atmosphere is important to us, and we produce various kinds of material pollutants and things like that. And we want to know how that affects the atmosphere.
Right.
And finally, after that, I worked on lightning on other planets. Other planets have lightning.
Uh-huh.
Jupiter has much more lightning than the Earth does.
Yeah.
And so that was interesting. And of course, one of the things that NASA is particularly interested in doing is exploring whether there's life in space. Are there other planets? And so basically, I proposed a program to do that in 1984, and I've been pursuing that ever since.
So the interest in looking for other planets, I mean, I would assume that depending on what type of a scientist or what discipline you're in, you know, some would be interested in the geology, some might be interested in climate, some might be interested in the orbital mechanics, the physics, the creation of solar systems. Is there any one particular focus that really drove you as your interest? You mentioned your physics background.
Well, if you're going to explore the galaxy, you've got to know whether there are any Earths out there to explore. And so the first problem that I wanted to address was, are there other Earths?
Yeah.
If there are, and there are lots of them, then there's probably lots of life in our galaxy, and we should build systems to go out there. If, on the other hand, we find when we look at a huge number of stars, there aren't any, that's a very different proposition. Mankind's direction in the future might be quite different depending on whether you find lots of Earth or you find there aren't any.
Now, of course, there's huge, profound implications, spiritual and otherwise, about being alone in the universe. But, you know, again, as I was saying, you know, growing up watching Star Trek, I mean, I just assumed naturally, I mean, why wouldn't you, that there would be dozens of planets around other stars filling our galaxy? You know, why would we be just the only place in the whole universe that would have planets around stars? So, go into Kepler...
We're not as smart as you might guess we are, and that is, before we'd found any planets, we had ideas about how planets would form. And they would form much like our own solar system. The rocky planets, you know, the Mercury and Venus, Earth and Mars, would be close to the star, because it was so hot when the stars, planets form, only rocky material could form.
Yeah.
And further out, you'd find the Jupiters, the Neptunes, all these gas giants. We found exactly the opposite. That told us our theories needed a lot of development. The Jupiters and things like that, which we really believe must form further out, were inside the orbit of Mercury, inside the orbit of Earth. And we thought all the orbits would be circular, and we had good arguments for that. Well, they're not circular. So everything we have done when we've explored space has surprised us. And that warns us not to be so self-confident. We think we know things, but you really need to go out and make the measurement. Then you know.
Well, and before we talk about the Kepler mission very specifically, give us sort of the lead up to it. What did we know about the existence of planets? Weren't there some indications from ground-based observatories that there were planets out there? We certainly had theories that they might be out there. What did we know about this before Kepler was launched?
Well, we certainly tried pushing the idea of Kepler in 1984. Nobody had found planets at that point. But 1995, some ground-based telescopes did find them, and they started finding Jupiters, not at 12-year orbits like in our Jupiter.
Right.
But four-day orbits.
Yeah.
4 days.
Unbelievable.
So just astoundingly fast orbits. And so 1995, the ground-based telescopes got good enough, the technology got good enough, and we were beginning to find giant planets in short-period orbits and in very elliptical orbits. So we knew right away, within the first 4 or 5 years after 1995, by the year 2000, that there were probably lots of planets, but they were very different. than we ever expected.
And I don't want to jump ahead of myself here because we're going to talk about what Kepler's what it's found and what you suspect is out there. But I'm curious, when you talk about these giant planets whipping around these suns in these short periods and all that, have you also found that these planets, when there's more than one planet around a system, are they in the same plane, like kind of like our solar system is, all the planets describing circles essentially in the same plane?
That's a neat question. First of all, we have found a lot of planetary systems where there are 3, 4, 5, even 6 planets in the same plane, and we see those planets.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, we find most of the systems we look at, we only see one planet. Now, what does that mean? It means the other planets, if they're there, have their orbits tilted, so we can't see them. We suspect they're there, but we don't know for a fact.
Okay.
So we know there's a bunch that do have these in plane, but we don't know about the rest.
Because as we'll talk about it, you detect these planets by the way they go in front of the star as it appears from the Kepler's perspective. And we'll get to that in a minute, but let's talk about Kepler mission and give us the big picture introduction. So you put this team together, you put the spacecraft together, and I mean, simply put, is it just to go find planets? What is the Kepler mission?
Well, the Kepler mission, of course, started many years ago, and we kept proposing it to people that it couldn't be done. But in 2001, we got acceptance. We started building the spacecraft. We had to put together an international team of scientists, and launched in 2009. And what it is it's sort of a space telescope, except rather than taking pictures, it measures the brightness of stars.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a spacecraft that orbits the sun. It doesn't orbit the Earth, and it looks at one area of the sky and constantly measures the brightness of 150,000 stars, looking to see if any of those stars winks for a while when a planet moves across it. And so you're looking at the brightness of all these stars, looking for planets across those particular stars.
And then that way you can detect what you think is a planetary object. But how do you know? Well, shoot, there's all sorts of questions I want to ask. But before we get to those, let me ask you this quick question. Remind us, for those who didn't watch Cosmos with Carl Sagan when they grew up, who is Kepler and his importance to the history of astronomy and why it's so ideal that it's named, the Kepler probe is named for Kepler?
Okay, that's fine. By the way, you mentioned Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was a member of this team for years.
Oh, really?
We proposed it and so on. So it was very nice to have him as a teammate. Of course, he's died at
that point. Yes, passed away, yeah.
Kepler, of course, was an astronomer that lived about 1570 to 1630, about the same time as Galileo.
Uh-huh.
Interesting enough, Galileo never would lend him a telescope, so Kepler never had a chance to look through a telescope.
Oh,
Kepler basically thought up the laws of planetary motion. How fast does a planet go around a star?
Yeah.
As a function of how far away it is. So we use that information, we use his laws to say, if we see these planets going across the star, we get the orbital period, how often that transit or that eclipse reappears, how close is the planet to the star? So we use his law to go from the orbital period to the distance from the star. And if we know the temperature of the star, the size of the star, we can calculate how warm the planet is. Is it warm enough to be in a habitable zone, for example?
We're going to get more into that here in just a minute. Everyone, please stand by as we pause for our usual 5-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a break, get you caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports, and then we'll be back to talk more about the Kepler mission with William Borucki from NASA Ames. Your calls always welcome, 321-768-1240. I'm Jim Bank. You're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
News Radio, I'm Liz White. Diplomacy first, force if necessary. President Obama at a pro-Israel conference in D.C. this morning saying he prefers diplomacy in preventing Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons. The president also making it clear he won't hesitate to use force if necessary.
Iran's leaders should understand that I do not have a policy of containment. I have a policy to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
The president warning too much loose talk of war helps Tehran and drives up the price of oil. It's a pro-Putin party on the streets of Moscow.
Hey, la, la, la.
Exit polls project Vladimir Putin's the winner of Russian presidential elections, and Putin himself is claiming victory, but not everyone's celebrating. The opposition alleges widespread violations. It's working to prove that and planning a protest march for tomorrow. Fox News, we report, you decide.
From the Fox Sports studios in Los Angeles, here's Turk Stevens.
We begin with the NBA. The Celtics lead the Knicks 83-78. They're just 2 minutes into the fourth quarter. Paul Pierce at 25 points. Celtics a big third quarter to overturn a five-point Knicks lead at the half. Coming up bottom of the hour, Heat and Lakers from Staples. The Heat 28-8. The Lakers 22-14, 7-3 in their last 10. Top 25 college basketball. Second half, number 14, Wisconsin. Leading Illinois late 64-54. Number one, Kentucky beat Florida 74-59 to go to 30-1. They've won 22 in a row. Florida State beat Clemson 80-72. Michigan over Penn State 71-65. Wolverines will grab a share of the Big Ten title with an Ohio State win over Michigan State. And that game starts at the top of the hour. Missouri Valley Conference title game at the half. Illinois State leading Creighton 31-30. NHL Rangers over the Bruins 4-3 in the third.
Here is your Brevard County forecast. We've got a cold front pushing through the area here this afternoon. Cloudy skies, some scattered showers, even a thunderstorm or two not out of the question. And a few of those thunderstorms might be heavy to potentially severe. We'll see a high of 73. Tonight, the front exits. Skies turn clear. The low drops to 45. Tomorrow for Monday, we'll start the work week with plenty of sunshine. The high 73. Monday night clear, down to 56. Then on Tuesday, it'll be a cloudy and breezy day, high in the upper 60s. I'm Jason Beck from the Weather Channel.
I'm Joel Matlin, president of Alarm Force. Have you ever been burglarized? Was the burglar caught? Crimes are committed every day, and unfortunately, without sufficient evidence, many burglars get away. That's why we've created the Alarm Force Video Relay. With an Alarm Force Video Relay, we're giving the police the best tool to catch criminals, video and audio evidence. The Alarm Force Video Relay is a small unit that's placed directly on the outside of your front door. Installation's easy, requires no drilling, and takes about an hour. Once installed, you can see and speak to whoever's at your front door through your cell phone. Full audio and visual communication, as if you were there in person. Plus, all actions outside your front door are recorded and stored in an online video archive. You can get an Alarm Force Video Relay for as low as $199 for installation and just $10 per month in a bundle.
Call 1-800-267-2001. Alarm!
Florida's best choice for home security. License number 553-1554.
The Washington Nationals are back on the Space Coast for the 2012 spring training season at Space Coast Stadium. Make plans now for the first Saturday game of the spring training season at 1:05 p.m. when the Nationals play the New York Mets. Get your tickets today at Nationals.com or opt for the Flex Plan, giving you the chance to purchase tickets for three games of your choice, including games against the New York Yankees. The Nationals play the New York Mets Saturday at 1:05 p.m. Individual tickets are on sale now, starting as low as $12. Log on to Nationals.com or call 888-632-NATS. It's the 2012 Washington Nationals spring training season at Space Coast Stadium.
Play ball!
Tonight on A&E, it's the return of Breakout Kings.
When we came onto this task force, we were told that our job is to chase and capture.
The danger of hunting fugitives is on the rise.
This guy's got over 36 killings on his belt.
But it's not always good to be king.
Get emergency personnel here now!
This season, one king will fall.
You never know.
When your number's up.
Breakout Kings, an all-new season premieres tonight at 10, 9 central, only on A&E.
Slip and fall, call 1-800-MORGAN-LAW. Morgan & Morgan, for the people.
Let's say you're away on business and you wanted to hear WMNB. Well, if you had the free iHeartRadio app, you could. Get yours now for the BlackBerry, Droid, iPhone, or iPad at WMNBAM.com. Keyword, iHeart.
Fast and accurate, fair and balanced. Fox News at the top of every hour on News Talk 1240 and 1350 WMNB. With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
And welcome back to our second half of Space Talk on WMNB. Our phone lines remain open for your contributions to the conversation we're having with William Borucki, a principal investigator with NASA's Kepler mission and the hunt for planets around other stars in our galaxy. Give us a call, 321-768-1240. or send an email with your question or comment to spacetalking@AOL.com. William's on the phone with us from his office at the NASA Ames Research Center at Moffett Field, California, a wonderful facility with a big hangar. William, is that Hangar 1 still sitting out there, that blimp hangar, or is that starting to be taken down now?
They've been stripping off the covering, and I believe they'll replace the covering, but people are really not sure. It's very expensive, and it's not clear what it would be used for, so material is being taken off, but I don't know what will become of it. Certainly the frame is still there.
Yeah, like our vehicle assembly building, it is a major fixture on the horizon there when you drive by the freeway. I mean, that's a cool place. Hey, we're talking about the Kepler mission to hunt for other planets, and we talked about the mission itself. We've talked about Kepler. We've talked a little bit about how we're doing all this. But let's get into the more specifics. When I first started thinking about Kepler and looking into it and understanding it, 3 years ago when it launched, you mentioned that it's a telescope, but it's not there to take pictures. And I'm thinking, you've got a star way the heck out there, I mean, light years away, and you're trying to detect this tiny little rocky thing or this little gas giant going across this little speck of light. And you talked about it winking. Where does that technology come from? I mean, the sensors, the photometers that are so sensitive to pick up that variation in light must be just absolutely incredible. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. This system is very much like a giant camcorder, just like the one that you have, in your lying around, except it's got an enormous telephoto lens. So the camcorder basically sits in space, and it gets images not of one star, but all the stars that are in its field of view. And at any given time, it's looking at about 4 million stars simultaneously. In some sense, it's taking pictures, although we don't send the whole picture back. We pick just the stars that we know are much like the sun. Mm-hmm. So there's about 150,000 stars, and we take a picture every 6 seconds. We pull out the stars of interest. We store that information, and we send it back to the Earth once a month, and then we look at the brightness of each star. We actually add up the frames, so we look at the star, how it changes in brightness every 30 minutes to see if a planet went by the star. If a planet goes by the star will get dim for a few hours, and we look at that and see if it repeats. The deeper the dip, the bigger the planet, because mm-hmm. it blocks more and more of the light. The longer it takes to repeat, the longer the orbital period, the further away the planet is from the star. So basically a giant camcorder taking pictures of all these stars constantly without moving. It just sits there in space, takes pictures over and over again of these 4.4 million stars, takes 150,000 stars, sends that information to the ground.
And so you're looking at, you say you're not taking pictures. We're looking at lines on a chart, graph lines. We're looking for numbers that just suddenly change in their value by some amount that I'm sure you've agreed on what the right amount is.
That's right. Basically, when you're measuring the brightness, if you'd like, you can imagine drawing in sort of a little graph. And the first point is, how bright was it at this time? How bright was it at next time? And so you get sort of a straight line. The star is constant. All of a sudden, dips down, stays down for a little while, goes back up, and stays constant again. And you look and say, there's my planet.
Yeah.
Now, you can get fooled because a small star orbiting a big star, and there are a lot of those, give you the same signature.
Sure.
So you've got to take ground-based telescopes and check. A ground-based telescope can check and see if it's really two stars. It can't tell you whether there's a planet there, but it can tell you whether or not you've made a mistake and there's really two stars instead of a star and a planet.
And the
so
ground...
I'm sorry. We use ground-based telescopes all the time.
Yeah, and the ground-based telescopes, again, because of the position of Kepler in its orbit, essentially those ground-based telescopes, they're looking at a little different angle. So if you compare the two pieces of information, you can tell whether it's two stars or not. Is that how it works?
No, not at all.
When
two stars go around, it's like two people on a teeter-totter, a child and a heavy person. You move the heavy person to the positions of the balances. Well, with the ground-based telescopes, we can actually see the star wobbling across the sky.
Okay.
We measure that wobble. And that wobble, if it's detectable, says, this isn't a planet. This is so big, it's got to be a star.
Okay.
So we can rule out those mistakes.
But again, we talked earlier about all these planets circling in the same plane, and you mentioned some might not be. You have to essentially have the coincidence of everything lining up just right for you to be able to detect that, and maybe that is in part why you're looking at so many stars at once, because you need that statistical opportunity to see that many more options for first planets to be out there.
Jim, you're exactly right. That's exactly how it's done, because if a star has lots of planets and the planets are orbiting in the plane of the sky, you'll never see them. Only if they're nearly lined up with your line of sight. You can calculate how often that occurs, because the orbits are randomly distributed. Stars are randomly distributed in the sky. And so that happens proportional to the diameter of the star. Bigger stars are better. And how far the planet's away from the star. Diameter of the star or the diameter of the orbit. And for planets that are in short-period orbits, like the first ones that were discovered, that's 10%. Yeah. But for planets that are out where the Earth is, that's about 0.5%. So if you take 0.5% and say, well, gee, one star, not worth it. 100 stars, you're still not going to see anything. 100,000 stars, you should see 500. So the game is look at lots of stars continuously. So even though the chance of alignment is not very great, you'll still find lots of planets, and you'll be able to correct the measurement for the fact that some of them won't be aligned properly. We can do that.
And by the way, for those of you listening at home and keeping track of this interview, I am now one and one in terms of being right and being wrong. So I'll take that record. I'll take that record. When we talk about Hubble, for example, and other telescopes that have this incredible ability to focus in on something, and we say, well, if you're standing at Ames and you go to New York City and it's within the width of a dime, and you know there's all these gee whiz figures. I'm just thinking about the amount of light flickering, the wink as you call it, being so infinitesimally small but yet still detectable. I mean, have you guys come up with any kind of the gee whiz, compare it to something that we could get a grasp of what kind of sensitivity this thing has?
Sure. Basically, imagine that the telescope was in Los Angeles and it was looking at a bunch of traffic in New York City. Mm-hmm. And it was looking at the headlights of cars. It was nighttime, and our telescope in Los Angeles was looking at these headlights, and it could tell there was a flea crossing one of the headlights.
Oh, yeah, there you go. That's incredible. That is incredible, as they say. I mean, and the technology that gives us that, I mean, we could make this into a nice big commercial for the space program in terms of where some of all this came from. But let's go to the scorecard now, William. Let's talk about... You've been up there for 3 years. I know you had some new announcements just this past week. Give us the chart of how many planets do you think are out there? How many have you confirmed? What are they like? Let's go over the numbers.
Okay. Well, we found – now, first of all, they're candidates. We find them. We think they're planets. We've got to go doing some checking with ground-based telescopes. Most of what we check find – they turn out to be planets. So we found some 2,300 planetary candidates. We believe at least 90% will be planets. So well over 2,000, and some of these are Earth-sized, mm-hmm. maybe 100 or so. They're Earth-sized. We find a lot that are at Jupiter-sized. I find many, many more that are Neptune-sized. Neptune is about four times the size of the Earth, so we find a very large number of those. And we're finding a few in the habitable zone of their stars, but generally the stars that we're finding in the habitable zone are cooler than the Sun. Lots of stars are much cooler than the Sun. Most of them are, in fact. And so we're trying to confirm those to make sure that, you know, it's not a small star around a big star. So we're still processing the data, doing ground-based telescopes with those. And we're finding orbital periods. From orbital periods like the Earth, you know, a year, half a year, a month, a week, we actually find orbital periods of one day. Mm-hmm. One day means that if you were on that planet and you were looking at seasons, you'd get up in the morning, it would be spring, the afternoon would be summer, the evening would be fall, and it would snow while you were asleep. So one season, one day. Now, these planets are so close to their stars, however, they're very, very hot.
Yeah.
In fact, they are molten lava. They're actually hotter than molten lava. So you'd have a planet that was basically an ocean of lava. And in fact, if you were to look at this planet, it would be identical for you to look into a blast furnace. They're that hot and that brilliant. Mm-hmm. They shine with their own light for some of the short-period orbits. Sure. So you're really looking for the ones that are much further from the star like the Earth is. They're cooler, and they're the ones that might be in a habitable zone.
And just a million questions to follow up on this. Been all the various permutations of what's possible. And I'm curious right away, you mentioned Jupiter-sized planet circling a star in what would be 4 days of our time or whatever. Neptune... If a planet is Neptune-sized from what you're seeing so far, is it necessarily a gas giant? I mean, is there a rocky planet as big as Neptune? Is there a gas planet as small as our own Earth?
we're explorers, and we don't know what we're going to find out there. And so I can't answer all those questions, but the belief is that if it's Neptune size and larger, it's probably mostly gas with some rocky material in the core, but you know, it would be a sort of a Neptune-like planet where you wouldn't have any solid surface. The rock might be dissolved in the gas. You need to get closer to twice the size of the Earth and smaller before we think it'll be rocky.
Wow, interesting. And we, with just about a minute left before we take our final break, William, let me ask you this. Talk to us about where are these planets? How far away are they? If I go up in the sky tonight and look, where do I look, and how far away are these things?
Well, if you were to look right now, you would look at the sun, because that star field is behind the sun right now. It will, the star field we're looking at can only be seen in a wintertime from the Earth.
Yeah.
And so it's Cygnus the Swan. You look up in the Milky Way in the middle of the summertime. At night, you'll see a swan flying through the Milky Way. We're looking at one of the wings of the swan.
Okay, stand by right there, William. We'll finish the rest of the question in a minute. We're going to take our final break of the day. When we come back, we'll wrap up our conversation about Kepler. Plus, we'll take a look at the local launch forecast. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to Space Talk. Stick around right here on WMMB.
TurboTax, what's your tax question?
Is your federal free edition really free?
Yes, it is.
And if I have questions, I can call a tax expert?
You bet.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, how expert-y are you?
I'm an 11.
Do your simple return with the TurboTax Federal Free Edition. It's free to prepare, print, e-file, and only TurboTax offers free one-on-one expert tax advice for everyone, live by phone and chat. Go to TurboTax.com. Live tax advice service is free and subject to availability restrictions and change without notice. See TurboTax.com for details.
Spring into action at Sports Authority. We've got everything your family needs to get active this spring and then some. Check out our Power Play deals, our best buys of the week. Like 3 for $18 on Champion tees and shorts for men and tees and tanks for women. That's right, just $6 each. Then run to the shoe department and save $20 on New Balance 310 running shoes at just $39.99. Whether your family needs to complete their workout wardrobe with shoes or apparel, get to Sports Authority. All things sports. Sporting good. Offer valid 3-4 through 3-10 in stores only. Exclusions may apply. See store for details.
The Washington Nationals back on the Space Coast for the 2012 spring training season at Space Coast Stadium. Make plans now when the Nationals play the St. Louis Cardinals, the 2011 World Series champs, at 1:05 p.m. Wednesday, March 7th. Get your tickets today at Nationals.com or opt for the Flex Plan, giving you a chance to purchase tickets for three games of your choice, including games against the New York Yankees. The Nationals against the St. Louis Cardinals Wednesday, March 7th at 1:05 p.m. Tickets on sale now, starting as low as $12. For more information, log on to Nationals.com or call 888-632-NATS. The Washington Nationals spring training season at Space Coast Stadium.
Play ball!
Log on to WMMBAM.com.
Baseball fans, it's our favorite time of the year again, spring training. The Washington Nationals and WMMB are giving you the chance to enjoy a game from the comfort of a luxury suite at Space Coast Stadium. WMMB will take you and nine of your friends to select games throughout the Grapefruit League season. Register now at WMMBAM.com and we'll see you at the ballpark with the Washington Nationals and WMMB.
And welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's edition of Space Talk. With a quick reminder that you can stay in touch with us throughout the week. If you're on Facebook, just search for Space Talk. And if you're on Twitter, our hashtag is Space Talking. And for one-stop shopping, just visit WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. Now, before we conclude our chat about the Kepler mission, let's take a moment, look at our weekly launch forecast. As we did mention earlier, the practice countdown for SpaceX's next shot, the Falcon 9, was this past Thursday. What's still ahead for them as they get closer will be a brief test of the ignition of the rockets before launch. And once they get past that, they'll be able to clear everything up, and choose a launch date, get on the range, and go ahead and launch again, targeting late April, a mission that's going to take their Dragon cargo spacecraft on basically a flyby mission of the International Space Station. If all goes well with that mission, the next one, the Dragon, will actually be able to dock with the space station, begin the, well, really a whole new era of delivering cargo to the space station commercially. Pretty cool. March 21st is a launch from the Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands, a Pegasus rocket. Why do we care about that? Because our friends and neighbors at the Kennedy Space Center are making up the launch team for that mission. They'll be flying out to the atoll. Take care of that launch, carrying New Star, a NASA satellite to study high-energy X-rays. We won't see that one fly, but we'll be looking forward to it. The next launch from the Cape here in our backyard, an Atlas V rocket still scheduled for launch April 27th. The launch window extending from 3:08 to 5:08 p.m. Eastern Time. It's the United Launch Alliance shot to carry another military communications satellite, this one called the Advanced Extremely High Frequency Satellite. So we look forward to that shot on April 27th. Now in the remaining moments, back with William Borucki, the NASA Kepler mission principal investigator, one of two, I believe, that are teamed together to lead this science team. And we've been talking about this mission to find planets around other stars. And, William, we have a question that came into us on the email, spacetalking@AOL.com, from Walter in Rockledge, and he's asking basically what is the planned lifetime of the Kepler spacecraft, its mission, and was curious about whether or not the James Webb telescope would have the capability to do some of this kind of planet detecting that Kepler is doing right now.
The mission has fuel for another several years. Our funds run out this November, however, so unless we our proposal is successful, the mission will shut down this November. We have put a proposal in basically to extend it for another 2 years, and you do 2-year extensions. We'd like to have this mission run 8 years so we can find the smallest planets, which come out toward the end of a mission rather than at the beginning of a mission. In terms of James Webb telescope, that telescope will not be able to find planets. Its focus is very tiny. It picks out a star at a time. We pick out 100,000 stars at a time. But what it will do is it will use the data from Kepler to say, oh, here are stars that have planets. Mm. Let's see if we can learn about their atmospheres.
Okay.
So they add a very important aspect, but they can't basically, because their field of view is so small, They basically cannot find planets unless they're extremely lucky.
Extremely, I was going to say, unless they're very lucky. Very complimentary then, and that sounds cool. And all of this really does lead up to what I really wanted to spend this final few moments with you talking about. We didn't quite say how far away some of these stars and planets are, because as soon as you're going to tell me that number, it's going to beg the question, you know, when do we get to go? And obviously we're talking, you know, centuries from now, but we think about planet survival of the species and finding other planets out there. Talk to us about how far away these planets are and kind of what the profound implications are of understanding that there are planets out there.
Well, most of our stars are pretty far away. There are a few that are within, you know, 30 light years or something like that, 100 light years. Most of them are at the order of 1,000 light years away. And so what we're trying to do is find the frequency of these planets. Are they common? Are they rare? And that basically leads to the next design, the next mission. One of the next missions will go and look at these planets to find the composition of their atmospheres. Do the atmospheres have water? That's great. If they have CO2, that's what a plant needs to live.
Mm-hmm.
Plants make oxygen. Do they have oxygen? So the next missions that would follow this need to know, are there lots of planets, which case they look at the nearby stars, or are there very few stars that have such planets, so they have to look a long distance in the galaxy. So that's probably the next thing that we're looking for. And, of course, in some sense, what we're doing with this mission is rewriting the textbooks, because we're finding, you know, how frequent are the Earths, what kinds of stars are they around, what kind of orbits do they have, and basically that's telling us something as well about our own solar system.
And
how did it form?
And as you look at all these stars and find these planets, and I'm not a guy, everyone knows, I took statistics 3 times and barely passed, but do you have a sample big enough, or are we even in the noise of, or have a statistically relevant sample to say, well, if there are this many planets around this many stars, then this must be the number in our galaxy?
We have that for the short period orbits, because in short period orbits we need at least 3 orbits to go by before we can say we found anything.
Yeah.
That means if you're saying, what about our Earth with 1-year orbit, we don't even have that data back from the spacecraft yet. But for the cooler stars where the orbital periods are shorter, for planets in the habitable zone, we do have that kind of information. And what we're finding is that something of the order of half of the stars that we look at, on average, every 2 stars at least have a planet.
And
we believe that number will be double when we finish, because we still haven't looked at the long period orbits. We're waiting on that information to come back from the spacecraft.
And I had a joke when you said cooler stars, we mean lower in temperature, not just because they're cool. So
that's true.
So
lower in temperature, exactly.
And I want to just real quickly, with just about 30, 40 seconds left, the habitable zone, changes by stars. It's that range of orbits where we think that basically life like what we know could exist.
It's basically where the temperature of the planet could have water on the surface. If the planet's too close to a star, the water boils off, the atmosphere becomes steam. If it's too far away, the water freezes, and you've got the oceans that are solid ice. And we don't think there's going to be life in any planets like that. We don't know for sure, of course. We're always surprised. But we're picking the planets which have the right temperature. We're saying those are in the habitable zone. Whether they're habitable, we don't know. Whether they have atmospheres, right now we don't know. A future mission will determine whether they have atmospheres. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have to determine, do they have oxygen?
Well, and we need to wrap up. 3 years ago, what, March 9th was the launch. You got a big anniversary. Has the time flown for you?
Oh, it's gone by in an instant. There's so much to do, so many discoveries we've been making. We've been revolutionizing our knowledge of stars and planetary systems.
And remind me again, birthday cake is in order. What was it, black cherry, and what was it?
It's going to be a devil's cake with a strawberry.
Okay, devil's food cake with strawberry. Everybody go out tonight, bake one, have it in honor of the Kepler launch. Of course, a lot of us here on the Space Coast saw that liftoff on the Delta II, a rocket that we missed, and hope we'll get one more off the ground here before too long. William, thanks for taking time to talk to us. I got about 100 other questions I want to ask you, so we're going to give you a chance to look at your data and have you come back another time and talk more about Kepler. Good luck with your mission extension.
I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Take off. Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Goodbye.
Hey, that's about it for now. You know how to get a hold of us at WMMBAM.com, keyword Space Talk. You'll be able to find everything, including a link to today's podcast, an archive of previous shows, and the online version of Orbital Inclinations. That's all for now. Space Talk, a production of Mylo Solutions. My thanks to Sean Williams for manning the ops station for today's program. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Can you believe it? For another live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of The Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Banky. We'll talk to you again real soon.
Good afternoon. At this check, there's no slowdowns on our roadways. We're good to go. I-95 between Titusville and Palm Bay. US 1.